is providing HA when SQL Server failover clustering. My name is Edwin. Max already gave you an overview of my background. I'm a Microsoft Certified Master as well as a Microsoft MVP. I focus mostly on high availability and disaster recovery. If you have any other questions during or after the event or after the webinar, feel free to send me an email, post your questions on the chat window. Make sure that everything is, if you're taking notes, feel free to do so. I will start the recording of my screen. Quick second here. Okay, just quick, session's being recorded at the moment. All right, so I usually start my presentation by telling a story, and this is a story that happened, I think, about 2 years ago when my youngest accidentally hit his nose in the corner of our closet. That was about 11 at night, and we were a bit worried, so the first thing that we did was take him to the emergency room. You know, you have certain levels of expectation when you go to the emergency room, like being attended to immediately. And so we went there hoping to get attended to immediately until an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours down the road, and 4 hours down the road, we are not being attended to, which somehow died down some of our expectations as far as emergency rooms are concerned. In fact, my youngest even commented about the fact that I think the swelling's gone just for the fact that we've been waiting here for 4 hours. And so I want to dive deep into how that certain level of expectations are set in terms of high availability and disaster recovery. And what do I mean by that? Businesses have different requirements as far as high availability and disaster recovery is concerned. Now, I'm going to be focusing mostly on high availability for this webinar. And I took this simple definition of what high availability means. It's a characteristic of a system that's fully operational for a long period of time. The goal is to keep the system fully operational as long as we possibly can, keeping the system up and running. I also want to take a twist on the word availability. Just because something is available doesn't mean it's operational, or availability is not the same as uptime. Now, again, going back to my story about being in the emergency room for like 4 hours, the emergency room is available, but nobody's servicing us. No staff nurses, no nobody. So even if it's available, we're not being served. And exactly the case when you're working with databases, I want to drive a point where we need to think of our systems as a complete system, not just on the database side, because nobody really cares if your database is up and running, if applications can connect to it. Maybe there's a network issue, or maybe there's an application issue. So you got to look at it in terms of the whole architecture, not just the database. Although this topic is primarily more on databases, and our focus is mostly on the databases, I want you to take a look at the whole architecture in general so that when you're having that conversation with your network engineers, your systems engineers, your application developers, you're on the same page as far as availability is concerned. And I'd like to take this quote that I usually tell my customers: just because something is up doesn't mean it's available. And again, going back to my story regarding that emergency room incident that we had. And when I talk about availability, I talk about a key phrase, recovery time objective, or the acronym RTO, typically thrown into conversation with regards to high availability and disaster recovery projects. But what is recovery time objective? Well, from my point of view, it's simply answering the question, when is my application coming back? And again, depending on who you ask, whether you're asking the application developer, the network engineer, the database administrator, or the systems engineer, they may have a different response as far as this question is concerned. The goal is to be on the same page. So if we're dealing with a mission-critical e-commerce sales system, asking the application developer, the network engineer, the systems engineer, and the database administrator, you should have a single answer as far as recovery time objective is concerned. And usually when I ask this question about what's your acceptable downtime, the typical response is, well, I want zero downtime. Now, let me explain a bit why I usually respond in a manner that I usually respond in terms of getting the answer of zero downtime, is setting the right expectations as far as what zero downtime means. Let's start off with percent availability. And this is typically measured in terms of zeros. So for example, you got 90% availability. How does that translate to in terms of downtime? Well, you look at it in terms of 36.5 days per year, or on average about 16.8 hours per week. Now we're looking at not so mission critical applications like your HR systems or maybe your internal systems that are not publicly facing or not revenue generating. This is a good enough number as far as our uptime or downtime is concerned. 1 9 is good enough. The more nines you add into the numbers, the lower the amount of acceptable downtime you'll have. For example, if you define your system to be 99% available, that means you're only allowed 3.65 days per year of downtime, or an average of about 1.68 hours per week of downtime. Let's add in one more nine. 3 9s, 99.9% availability, translating into 8.76 hours per year of downtime, or on average, 10.1 minutes. Now, you look at the big difference between 1 9 versus 3 9s, from days acceptable downtime per year to hours. What about adding a number, another different 9 into the mix? Well, 4 9s, look at the numbers, 52.56 minutes of downtime allowable per year. On average, 1.01 minutes or 1.1 minute per week. Let's throw in one more nine just for the sake of it, because again, customers will say, I want 5 9s or even more if that's even possible. But I want to set expectations about the number of seconds, we're talking about seconds now, from days to seconds of downtime per week. That's 6.05 seconds per week of acceptable downtime. And a typical question that I ask is, well, really, you want me to provide 99.999% availability to your SQL Server databases? Do you even know how long it takes to restart SQL Server? And the reason I'm asking this question is because throughout the year, you may be allowed several seconds of downtime per week, but you got to install security updates because your SQL Server databases are still running on top of Windows. So your mission-critical databases will still need to be rebooted or restarted based on what security updates are available or patching. And these are scheduled downtime. What about unscheduled downtime, you know, when power outages happen? And think about this. How long does it take to restart SQL Server? That in itself should give you some ideas about what your availability or percent availability would be given the right circumstances. And again, I'm not just even talking about just restarting SQL Server. And part of that is every time you do a restart of the SQL Server service, crash recovery occurs, which means SQL Server will have to read through the transaction log, look at committed transactions, roll back uncommitted transactions, and if you've got tons and tons and tons of transaction log records on your log files, that would factor into the amount of downtime that your databases, not just the instance, but your databases, would experience. And I usually refer to this graph in terms of availability or recovery time objective in reference to total cost of ownership. And I'm not just talking about one-time setup, configuration, cost of buying hardware, software, maintenance. I'm looking at the overall total cost of ownership that factors into operations and maintenance cost, your IT support, and replacing your hardware throughout, or hardware or software throughout the lifetime of your system. And if you look at the graph as you approach zero downtime, the cost exponentially increases. And that is something that you need to factor in and understand when you're dealing with or even thinking about implementing high availability and disaster recovery solutions. So the next time somebody tells you, or maybe you're planning on a disaster or high availability or disaster recovery solution, and you know upper management asks for zero downtime, start asking those questions. How much downtime can we afford, and how much are we willing to pay for it? Now, because this is a SQL Server centric presentation, I like to focus on the high availability features available in SQL Server. Let's start off, and I've taken this from SQL Server books online, let's start off with some of the features that you can easily, well not necessarily easily, but implement that would address high availability requirements. I'm a big fan of Server Core just because of the fact that it keeps people from logging in directly to the machine. It's Windows without Windows. Think of it as Windows without the typical GUI. SQL Server relational database, or the database engine, is supported to run on Server Core. And because there's not a lot of components to patch, there's not a lot of security updates installed, and therefore not a lot of reboots. Plus, of course, I can prevent some people from logging in because they won't be able to see anything except from the command, for the command line. We also have features like database mirroring, and it's still there. It's still in SQL Server 2014, although it has been deprecated in SQL Server 2012. But it's still there. One of the reasons why I still recommend database mirroring is because of the fact that, you know, licensing between standard and enterprise editions, big difference. Plus, with the licensing cost in terms of 2008 and 2012 from per CPU to per CPU core, big price difference as far as that is concerned. So it's still there, you can use it, but again, plan for future deprecation in future versions. The most common ones that I see out there, starting with SQL Server 2012, is failover cluster instances. This is your traditional failover cluster, SQL Server instances running on traditional failover cluster, and then the availability groups, which was introduced in SQL Server 2012. Looking at some of the columns, there, the columns actually refer to the edition of that particular SQL Server installation that you're running on to support that specific feature. Let's look at availability groups. Why am I starting off with availability groups? Well, it's the hot thing since SQL Server 2012. It's been recommended, vouched for as far as high availability and disaster recovery solutions are concerned. And as I mentioned, this was designed to replace database mirroring in terms of using SQL Server 2012 and higher. This provides protection to a group of database, contrasting that with database mirroring, where database mirroring will protect a database. But there are certain applications, for example, SharePoint, because I've worked with a lot of SharePoint environments, where you need the entire group of databases that work with SharePoint to fail over, not just one, but every single one of them to fail over as part of your application architecture. Now, this can be used as both a high availability and or a disaster recovery solution. It just depends on what architecture you want to put into and how much you're willing to pay for, just like what we talked about in a previous slide. I kind of use this as a reference for availability groups as a combination of database mirroring and failover clustering. And how that works is, imagine database mirroring, where initially you've got a principal and mirror. Your transaction log records get copied over from your principal database to your mirror database. And for automatic failover, if you have a witness, you have a quorum that decides if something happens to the principal, the databases will be failed over automatically to the mirror, making it the new principal database. With availability groups, the app has been replaced with Windows Server failover clustering. Failover clustering takes care of help detection, automatic failover between the nodes, and the resources that are running on top of the cluster. Of course, depending on, again, your budget and the version of SQL Server that you're using, you can have a maximum of 8 replicas. 8 replicas in SQL Server 2014, 5 replicas in SQL Server 2012, or 4 secondary replicas, plus 8 secondary replicas in SQL Server 2014. Now, the bigger challenge that I see with implementing availability groups, I'm a big fan of availability groups. When it was first introduced, I've had an opportunity to play around with this even before SQL Server 2012 was released, and I love it. I love the fact that I now have the capability of failing over automatically, you know, having readable secondaries so that I can offload my read-only replicas to my standby or my secondary replica if I want to do that for HA and factor in another replica for disaster recovery. The bigger challenge here is really cost. I mentioned earlier, when you talk about the changes between the licensing from 2008 to 2012 from per processor to per CPU core, and when you do the math, even on the same hardware, you kind of think of how that factors in as far as the licensing is concerned. Database mirroring only requires, well, standard edition is more than enough for database mirroring if you don't want to do asynchronous mirroring. But availability groups require SQL Server Enterprise Edition for you to implement it, regardless of whether you're doing just one secondary replica or more. And this is where failover clustering play a very, very important role. With failover clustering, now there, I do have a question on the chat here. How do you get to FCI and Starland faster? We'll talk about how that thing works in a couple of slides. I mean, switch real quick to that. Now, I've talked about failover clustering, and I've talked about how availability groups depend so much on the underlying Windows Server failover clustering. But let's look at how failover works in the context of the storage. So how does failover clustering work in terms of SQL Server, and how does storage factors into it? Technically, the storage is owned by only one cluster node at a time, which means even though you have physical connection from the different nodes in the cluster, you only have one logical path to the storage. What that means is when you're running SQL Server on, and this is again a traditional failover clustered instance, when you're running SQL Server on the left side or the left node, your transaction workload, your inserts, updates, deletes, your BCP, or any of your transactions will only go through that logical path to the storage. Now, during failover, the storage gets logically dismounted from the failed node, or if it's not a forced failover, a manual failover, it gets logically dismounted from that node and remounted on the new active or the new primary node. How does that work? Well, imagine again, there's a failover that happens, your node goes down, connectivity, not logical, not physical, because even though you shut down the server, it's still connected to the storage, but then the logical connection moves from the failed node to the new node. And when that happens, the failover, SQL Server resource or resources, a resource group has to wait until the disk goes online prior to bringing the SQL Server clustered resource online. Now, the amount of time it takes to bring the storage online depends on how long it takes to mount the storage to the new primary node. In fact, if you look at the cluster dependency report, SQL Server, this good cluster resource or the EXE, depends on making sure that the storage goes online first before the SQL Server service can be brought online. Now, since we're focusing on CSV or cluster share volumes, there are now multiple paths to the storage, which means that we're adding additional routes to the storage. What does that mean as far as SQL Server is concerned? Well, with cluster shared volumes, I still have dependency on the storage because that's where my databases are stored. But I don't need to remount the storage on the new active or primary node after failover, which means when I fail over, SQL Server will see it there and can be brought online faster versus waiting for the storage to get remounted to that node. And I don't know how long that usually takes, depending on my testing. And then waiting until it becomes online before SQL Server goes online. Of course, the goal with cluster shared volumes is to reduce downtime while increasing resiliency and reliability. Since we talk about dedicated storage for a failover clustered instance, one of the limitations that we have is I only have certain letters in the alphabet to work with available drives, which means if you're following the best practice of dealing with different storage for data, your log files, your backups, or dedicated drives for specific databases because they're more I/O intensive, you're limited by 23 drive letters when you're provisioning this. With cluster shared volumes, it makes it easier for me to just provision drives, as long as they're shared drives, present them as CSV, and then it only appears like a single folder as far as SQL Server is concerned with multiple subfolders, but those subfolders are physical connections or physical drives mounted to the cluster, which means I no longer have to worry about memorizing the alphabet as far as failover clustered drives are concerned. It also changes the concept of exclusive ownership of the storage. What that means is there is no direct there's no direct dependency as far as SQL Server is concerned. Again, I mentioned this earlier. When I fail over SQL Server, I don't have to worry and wait until the storage goes online. It will see the storage as being online on the other nodes. It's still dependent, of course, on the underlying storage because, again, just like your standalone instance, your database files are on your storage. But SQL Server no longer has to wait until the storage goes online for it to be brought online, which means, again, better resiliency and reduced downtime. In a traditional cluster, we're looking at a separate storage architecture, a separate storage area network just for our storage. That was the concept where why we have SQL Server working with your database files on your storage area network, so that when it fails over, all of my databases are in the same shared storage, and all the failover cluster is doing is just remounting it on the new target or the new node that the cluster decides to host the SQL Server resource. And the good thing about this is I can deal with a traditional two-node cluster even when using SQL Server Standard Edition. I mean, I could just use SQL Server Standard Edition, whether it's 2008 and higher, and install that on two-node cluster. So long as you don't go above two nodes for your cluster, you can do that. But there's still some dependencies on the underlying storage, because again, that underlying storage is outside of the cluster nodes. When you think about it, there's performance implications as far as that is concerned, because you're traversing multiple layers of the I/O stack in order to access your database files. You're thinking about your connectivity, your physical connectivity from the server to the storage. You're looking at the firmware. You're looking at the NTLM drivers to access the storage, and much, much more. This is where Starwind software comes into the picture, and this is where you can replace your traditional storage area networks with local storage. You could provision your traditional direct attached storage, store your databases on those, and let Starwind high availability take care of how the replication works within those two. And because the storage is local, it's definitely a lot faster than having to go through the I/O stack from the cluster nodes down to the underlying storage subsystem just to access the databases. Now let me switch over to Max to talk about how Starwind works and how that provides additional availability in terms of cluster shared volumes or just your overall storage when dealing with SQL Server workloads.
Great. Edwin, thanks for the presentation. And basically, what Starwind does in this configuration, first of all, it allows us to get rid of proprietary shared storage required for SQL always on FCI. So we don't need SAN anymore. We simply use the local storage and replicate the data between the servers, just as we could do with the SQL on, always on availability groups. And that made with less licensing efforts and also more benefits. So on the picture here, you see a basic diagram of how we mirror things. So you don't see any proprietary hardware here. You don't see any HBAs, any FC equipment here. We simply use two standard servers. We use SQL Server 2014, and we use Starwind. So there is no special source for this configuration. It uses standard Ethernet to mirror the data between the servers. It provides local storage back to the SQL Server as a highly available shared storage resource, which is then converted into a CSV and presented to SQL. And Edwin will show you that in just a few minutes. And Edwin, would you please move on to the next slide? Thank you so much. Basically, with dropping the two enterprise licenses necessity and with dropping the shared storage, we can simplify the deployment and lessen the deployment price by three times at least. This is the calculations I made on average SAN array, standard 3 units to 4-unit storage array using iSCSI with fiber channel that could be more, and of course with dropping additional licensing requirement. Then one more thing about Starwind is that you can get much better performance with just local storage. So your I/O path is much shorter than with a physical SAN, and also it is not just a path from your application to the disk using some native caching. We expand those capabilities and provide additional features to it. Basically, on the diagram we've seen on the previous slide, we not only have data replicated between the servers on the disk level, we also replicate the RAM of these servers to get you redundant write caching for your array, as well as we maintain flash caching, which is not mandatory, but you can add it if necessary and you want to enjoy high performance with SSDs. And all that is used with just standard licensing. So Edwin can tell you more about SQL licensing and how you can use flash and RAM caching with higher scale licenses of SQL, but Starwind offers these features just using the software itself. So you don't really need to go for higher SQL licenses to get more performance and get more features for your database. All that is accompanied with more features like snapshots, internal and multi-node storage tiering, as well as offsite replication, but we will not focus on those during this event. I think we can just move to the demo right away, and Edwin will show you how easy it is to configure the storage with Starwind and then provision it to SQL Server 2014.
All right, thanks, Max, for that quick introduction on Starwind. I'm always looking for opportunities to make or drive costs down as far as SQL Server deployments are concerned. And of course, you can only do so much as far as licensing is concerned, but you can find alternatives as to how you could improve not just your deployments, but also reduce your cost. And this is where I start using products like Starwind software for such deployments. Demo environment. So I have in here I hope you can see my screen. I have in here a typical two-node cluster. And one of the reasons I'm using a two-node cluster is it's the most common deployment out there. And again, as I mentioned, you can do a standard two-node failover clustered instances using Standard Edition. And that's why it's a common deployment for high available SQL Server databases. I have Starwind software running, and I've got like these are, again, my servers running on my cluster. I've already created my Windows Server Failover cluster here, which has two nodes. Those two nodes have local storage running on them. I've already provisioned the disks to those nodes using iSCSI. Well, let me just quickly show you how easy it is to create a new storage cluster. Let's say I'm going to name this iSCSI cluster. And I'll add my existing server to the cluster. I'll use the appropriate address. I'll specify what network or which networks that I provide because I'm using iSCSI. I've got a couple of paths to my storage. And then I'll add another server in mix. And there we go. I now have my storage or my servers added as highly available storage. And as I mentioned, I've already configured some of these storage on my cluster just to shorten the time and just to configure some of those storage for me to use with SQL Server. I can create a cluster storage in my cluster, and I'll probably name this cluster disk, say, M. I'll just use 1 gigabyte for this, just for a quick demo. I'll add both of my servers that I've already configured with Starwind software. Initializing storage, and now once that's done, part of that is actually replicating storage between my two servers. So this is cluster disk M, which I just created, and that gets replicated over. Whether you want it synchronous or asynchronous, for high availability, it's totally recommended to highly recommended to make it synchronous. Getting replicated over from this node to this node. I'm going to present that over to my cluster. I have a new disk that appears.
Edwin, I think you need to click the connect storage on the servers link.
Yeah,
exactly.
What is that about that? Connected. Now I just connected the storage. And you could verify this as well. Especially if you're dealing with the iSCSI storage, you could verify that and take a look at the iSCSI initiator properties to validate that the disk has been attached to the storage. Click refresh. There we go. make that online, initialize it. I just have to remember that it's disk 7, because when I add that over to my cluster, so I totally add the disk to my cluster. And that was disk 7 with a gigabyte capacity. And there it goes. Again, part of the best practice is making sure that I configure my naming convention properly. I'll make this disk, SQL disk, maybe M. And that's that. Now, these are all just the standard shared storage as far as Windows Server Failover Cluster is concerned. Nothing fancy. We can simply add them, all of these, to cluster shared volumes. It's as easy as selecting this, right-click, and adding that to cluster shared volumes. Okay. Of course, I won't be using my disk W because I've configured that to be a witness or disk witness in my quorum. Now, every time you add a clustered or a shared disk to the cluster shared volume, it creates sort of like a mount point in my cluster storage folder. And this folder exists on all of the nodes in my cluster. So now I could rename this to say SQL disk I. Again, part of best practice, just to make sure that you get to rename your drives, because it makes it easy for SQL Server to use them during installation. So let me just quickly run through the installation and just show you how you can now present those clustered shared volumes to SQL Server. Now, cluster shared volumes have been around since Windows Server 2008. They were designed for Hyper-V workloads. And starting with SQL Server 2014, we can now use clustered shared volumes in terms of adding our SQL Server databases into the clustered shared volumes. You have to make sure that you provision your clustered shared volumes so that during the installation, all you have to do is just point your SQL Server installation to the location of your clustered shared volumes. Typical installation, until we come to a point where it asks us for the folders, where do you want to place your data files, your log files. And the reason I have multiple drive letters here, or multiple drives, is I'm following the SQL Server best practice of, if I have a mission-critical database, I want to separate the data file from the log file, and I could just use a separate drive for each of them. I'm going to use the default installation. I'm only going to select the database engine, provide my instance name and whatever is necessary. I'm just going to go through this up to a point where I'm being asked for the disks where I want to install my SQL Server instance. And again, a couple of things in mind here. SQL Server 2012 introduced the feature where you can install or you can store your tempdb on a local drive. So I'm just going to name this SQL 2K14 and dealing with a default instance for this case. I'll provide a virtual IP address that I can use to connect to my my cluster. So I'm just going to use the default resource group name for the installation. This is where I mentioned about using the drives. Now, I've added those drives to my cluster shared volumes. And all I need to do now is, because I've provisioned them for use within my SQL Server installation, I can just point to the folders where I have my shared drives in. I'll just put in an IP address here, say 77. And then for server configuration, SQL service, provisioning my service account, And again, I'm just taking some of the defaults here because I want to move to the point where I'm providing where I could store my data files and log files. And this is what I was mentioning. I want my data root directory to be on SQL disk I. My data files will be on I. My log files will be on J. And then I want my tempdb to be on my F drive. And this is, as I mentioned, this is a local drive. Whether you're dealing with traditional SAN or storage like Starwind software, I'll store my tempdb data files on my local drive because, well, they get recreated every time you restart SQL Server, so there's no sense in putting them on a shared drive. And I'll put my backup directory on my K. So this is how we utilize cluster shared volumes within the context of SQL Server. And now I'm provisioning my disk I, which is, again, a shared storage just added to cluster shared volumes. My data and log files are on separate drives as well as my backups. This will prompt me for a warning saying that my tempdb files or my tempdb database is or will be stored in a local directory and just gives you that warning saying you gotta grant read and write permissions to the SQL Server service on that specific local drive, making sure that it has the same drive letter, same path, same folder, same permissions on all the nodes of your cluster. And this will just go ahead and install. So that's about it for how you configure SQL Server 2014. Particularly failover clustered instances to use clustered shared volumes with Starwind software working in the mix. If you want to learn more, and this is just a quick promotion of what I'm doing next week. In fact, I'm so excited to do this. I'll be doing a Windows Server failover clustering for the SQL Server DBA where I'll be covering more depth into what we've already covered. So from the basics, there's a bit.ly link down there if you want to join us for this particular workshop. It's a 4-day workshop, half-day, 4-day workshop, again, where I dive deep into Windows Server Failover Clustering, the underlying architecture, the principles, the concepts behind it, why SQL Server relies so much on it. If you have any further questions, now's the time to ask those questions. We could answer those questions, you know, if you have any specific questions about Starwind software, Max is there to answer those for you. If you have any specific questions as far as SQL Server is concerned, I'm more than happy to answer those questions for you.
Okay, so let me start with reading the questions from our audience. So Michael is asking our question, 8 replicas in SQL Server Standard or Enterprise Edition. So Edwin, what's your comment on that?
Just to repeat the question, is availability group standard or enterprise, whether it's synchronous or asynchronous, as availability group is an enterprise edition feature.
Okay, thanks. Now, let's see. What is the operating system requirement for configuring SQL 2012 availability groups?
Good question. SQL Server 2012 works with Windows Server 2008 and higher. I'm not going to make recommendations about Windows Server 2008 just because of the fact that, well, it's 2015. It's almost a 7-year-old operating system. I would go with the latest, not just because of the fact that I want to go with the latest. It's because of, again, the total cost of ownership. And again, I'll dive back into your question. SQL 2012 will work with Windows Server 2008, but got to install the right patches to make sure that you're dealing with asynchronous storage, because keep in mind availability groups do not need shared storage. They will work with local storage because they have, you know, each SQL Server instance will have its own copy of the database. And again, Windows Server 2012 R2 is the way to go if you want to provide higher availability for your SQL Server databases, whether you're using availability groups or failover clustered instances.
Okay, thank you. And now a few more questions. what are the requirements for round trip delay between two Starwind HA servers? So that, I guess that's something for me. The basic requirement is to have up to 3 milliseconds between the servers, and if they're located in two different buildings, so they're like separated sites, we support up to 7 milliseconds. And you can always find up-to-date information on Starwind website in the system requirements section. One more question. Let's see. What if the local storage is a NAS at two sites? In this case, Starwind is yet not able to handle a NAS as storage, but we're working in that direction as well, and I think in a few months you will be able to use a NAS as your storage to virtualize with Starwind. So you'll effectively replicate from one NAS to the other. Okay, more questions. Any plan by Microsoft to make Always On available to Standard Edition?
Very good question. Trust me, we've asked that question even before SQL 2012 went out.
Yeah.
I am still waiting.
Yeah.
The community is still waiting.
And I remember there was a guy who asked the question, like, why Microsoft put a RAM limitation in a certain version, and Microsoft actually came back and said, okay, we'll increase the RAM limitation. So maybe when the community raises this to a certain online discussion, Microsoft will say, okay, here's your availability groups.
It's also one of the reasons why we keep asking people for feedback. As a Microsoft MVP, again, we have the opportunity to talk to the product group, but we sometimes sound like we're just complaining. So we're asking the community, if you like a specific feature and you think that there's some limitations, provide use cases and business benefit as to making that happen. I'm a big believer in SQL Server. In fact, for years they've been going on with the licensing of just using it per CPU, whereas Oracle and DB2, they've been doing it on a per core basis. I think it's about time that Microsoft played a level playing game.
Okay, and here is another one. How will this scenario look in case of SQL servers running in VMs? iSCSI to both machines or shared VHD will be preferred. So I think I'll handle this one. The virtualized scenario can have Starwind running on much lower levels. So it's not necessary in this case to run Starwind inside the VMs. That is also supported, but in most deployments we see where SQL is running inside virtual machine, Starwind is acting as a fundamental storage for not only SQL but the rest of the environment as well. Okay, and just one more question and we'll have to wrap up. And if there will be any more questions which remained unanswered, I will definitely make sure they get either to my inbox or to Edwin's inbox, and we'll send you the answers to them. So the last question, on virtual machine, what would be the max DOP and cost parallelism threshold if two CPUs? Edwin.
That's a very good question, and you'll probably see a lot of the feedback and even comments on the internet out there about max DOP. And to be perfectly honest, there's no right or wrong answer there, because only you know your workload. I kind of think of it in terms of a general guideline where OLTP databases, go figure. Data warehouse workloads, set it to max DOP equal to 1 or a specific number. And unless you have, there's no problem with parallelism. It's a natural side effect of how databases work, especially with multiple processors. It's not supposed to be treated as a problem. However, it should be looked at as a symptom. A symptom of what? So for example, CX packet wait type is the top wait type if you're doing wait statistics analysis, and you see CX packet wait type. Does that mean, well, your SQL Server is using multiple processors or multiple cores to process a query? Maybe it's your indexing is not fine, or maybe your statistics is not properly updated, or maybe there's something else. So I don't see parallelism as an issue. Whether you're running on a VM physical, two CPU, more than that CPU, but understanding your workload and understanding what's causing that to provide a better approach and not just using a maxed off equal to one approach for everything. And again, it goes back to understanding what your workload really is.
Okay, Edwin, thank you so much. And thank you all for attending our today's event. I hope it was interesting for you. Thank you, Edwin, for joining us today and providing a great presentation. I especially enjoyed the nines part. And stay tuned for our future events. And make sure you attend our every Thursday tap room, where my colleague Anatoly will be following up on the high availability topic in a more relaxed and laid-back atmosphere.